so ready to get started again. The mics are live again. So just to warn you about that, and I think we'll pass straight to Catherine. You're going to take us through the principles of disclosure.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Daryl. Okay, good morning, everybody. So we have an hour, I believe, to talk about the Principles of Disclosure Project. Before I summarise our objectives for this session and what we'd like to discuss, I thought it was worth just taking a minute to summarise where we are within the context of the project. So on slide two, we have a timeline showing broadly what we've been up to in the last year, and where we find ourselves right now is preparing for the board's March meeting in 2 weeks' time, at which we'll be asking them to make decisions about next steps on the project. And these are potentially quite big decisions, because as well as receiving feedback on the discussions in the DP, we've also received a lot of feedback from stakeholders about the focus of the project and the fact that what they'd like the board to do is think about what the biggest priorities are, where they can make the most difference in helping to improve the disclosure problem and narrow the focus of the whole project accordingly. So the decisions that will be being taken in March are potentially quite significant, which brings me on to what we'd like to discuss today. So we have previously talked about the topics in the DP and received feedback on those. One of the challenges that the board faces in making decisions about next steps is balancing the views we've heard from different respondents and different types of stakeholder and making the best decisions about what to do going forward. So what we'd like to do in this session is summarise for you some of the specific areas of feedback that we'll be making decisions about soon and ask for your views in light of the feedback that we've heard from different stakeholders. So we've got three quite specific areas and three quite specific questions we'd like to talk to you about today. The first one is probably the priority for us, so if we spend a bit of time here, that's absolutely fine. The more views, the better, as far as we're concerned. So from slide five, we've got a summary of what we have broadly titled Addressing the Disclosure Problem. And what we are really talking about here is the fact that we've heard feedback from almost all respondents that answered the DP saying that they think there is something the board can do to help address the disclosure problem, but we've heard some different views about what the most useful activities would be. So on slides six and seven, we have got a summary of two of the different perspectives that we've heard that the board will need to think about balancing when they're making decisions. On slide six, we've got a summary of some views we've heard from a good proportion of preparers who think that ultimately one of the underlying causes of the problem is the volume and prescriptive nature of requirements in IFRS standards, and think that performing a standards level review with an objective of perhaps making those requirements a bit less onerous may give preparers more time to apply judgment in deciding what to disclose and how best to communicate. On slide seven, we've got a view that is held by many users of financial statements who are really more concerned about the information that's missing. In other words, they're less concerned about getting too much information in response to prescriptive or voluminous requirements and will be more keen on the board identifying the things that are missing and doing something to address that. So our first question is really about the balance of those two views, and an open question for any thoughts you have on those two different perspectives and advice for the board on how they might go about thinking about them. The other element of the question we have here is about the idea of standards level review more generally, and if you do support the board doing a standards level review and looking at existing requirements, how you feel about the potential objectives and scope of that review, whether you'd want it to have all IFRS standards within its scope or to be more targeted to specific standards, and what your objectives would be if the board were to go down that route. So a few open questions there, but within this remit, we are keen to get as many opinions as possible in preparing for our March meeting. So with that, I will hand over for discussion.
Anybody want to start the ball rolling?
The point I was raising in the earlier session is that there are overlaps between this project and other projects. And this is one such issue where you are covering disclosure, but then disclosure should be another initiative to be disclosed in respective standards. So now it appears that conceptually the board has agreed tentatively on that approach, that rather than it being a separate standard, it will be individual standard disclosure will be addressed. Do I take it that way?
I think we might be talking about two slightly different things. So one issue is what comes out of the Principles of Disclosure Project directly, which will be some form of general disclosure standard, which will be either an update to IS1 or possibly a new standard to replace IS1 or maybe even spread among more than one standard. And then the second issue is about the standards level review, if we do one. The board's idea so far has been that we would look at maybe two or three standards or two or three areas across some standards and test the general principles that we're developing in those specific areas. So it's two different streams of work, I think, we're talking about that.
Okay. In that case, we would prefer targeted approach. And in doing so, I have a suggestion, is that the recently developed standards should be avoided because these are deliberated very recently. And definitely those will come for review under improvement plan. So therefore, we should target the older standards first, and then later on we can come to the new standards. But a targeted approach is a better approach.
Do you think then specifically that it is the older standards that cause the disclosure problem?
Yeah, I mean, the disclosure, if in general the users are having this perception that a better disclosure will put them in a better position to understand the financial statements, then what exactly is missing, how it can be addressed is another matter. I'm not going into that. But in order to address that concern of the users, I mean, it should be a targeted approach and not general approach.
Not to pick on you, but how do you define the disclosure problem as you see it from? Do you think it is overly prescriptive requirements then that is the primary driver?
No, it was. I'll just give an example. Take for example the lease standard, which has been recently developed. Now there are certain disclosures which have been made mandatory in the form of tables, and a lot more information have been now made mandatory, which is helping the user to understand the position. So likewise, there could be many other areas where this better disclosure will... I were discussing in the previous session is that the standard has to be relevant to the time. So in order to be relevant, we should be addressing the concern of the users. So that is why I'm saying that it can be a targeted thing. And standard by standard, we have to understand what is the shortcoming and what else will be satisfying the users.
I think as a preparer, I'd be a little bit concerned about going and doing a comprehensive review of all standards in the U.S., when we started to do some disclosure projects, in almost every case that resulted in expanded disclosures. And unfortunately, I think the viewpoints of the investors are heard more loudly or taken into consideration more than the views of the preparers and whether or not all the disclosure requirements are really needed and justified from a cost-benefit perspective. So I'd be uncomfortable with a broad approach. I do think there are some things that could be done, identifying what the objectives are of the disclosures within the standards to encourage preparers to exercise judgments that I think are not necessarily being done now. I think sometimes companies or preparers are less inclined to push their auditors and just provide disclosures when perhaps you could justify not having them due to an assessment of materiality or qualitative materiality even. I think preparers are probably just as much the problem as the standards themselves. I think that perhaps if we encourage auditors and regulators to apply more judgment in evaluating the shall or should type of language that exists in some of the standards and allow more judgment to be applied, that could be another method to move the disclosure overload concerns that preparers have.
Given what you said earlier about preparers not doing enough, do you think then that's primarily about signaling rather than actually substantively changing what a preparer is required to do?
I think preparers are uncomfortable challenging when the auditors are point out, oh, that says shall, that means you have to do it. Some preparers are more comfortable telling the auditors that, that may well be, but there's an overarching principle of materiality that applies in evaluating the applicability of all standards and all disclosures, that I think that principle needs to be developed more and encouraged and encourage preparers to use that to go through and be thoughtful about what they're disclosing instead of providing all the prescriptive requirements.
Could I ask a question just to clarify something? It's probably worth saying in respect to my overview, I mean, the standards level review point is one of the things that is up for consideration, and we've brought it to the table today because it is somewhere where we have got these different views, and it's really useful to get your opinions. The board will also be considering whether there would be benefit to doing something more overarching in terms of something more sort of central or principles rather than individual standards level. And I'm just interested from what you said in whether you think that would be more or less beneficial compared to doing something at the standards level.
I think if you are trying to address something broadly, you could provide some clarification that when you say shall or must, that you need to balance that with an assessment of materiality. And that may address some of that. But I think the overall objectives should be at more standard level. If you add a whole new standard on evaluating disclosures, I think it can just result in more work in going through and documenting your compliance with that disclosure versus documenting it at an individual standard level.
Leon?
Yes. You are speaking about two approaches, a targeted review and a comprehensive review. When you are talking about targeted review, because you are talking about removing necessary requirements and add additional requirements, that would then how? What would be your drive in doing that? What would be the, you will be looking at the objective of each standard or each disclosing in each standard in order to put or to take out the things? And what would be then this objective? What would be how you will be writing this objective? I agree with Sandra. It need to be done standard by standard. But how do you work with the objective of disclosure?
This question wonderfully sort of brings out the discussion point that we are aiming for today, because the position that we are currently in is that we've had a lot of feedback from people who think that standards level activity would be helpful. Now, if the board decided to go down that route, I think it's probably fair to say that would involve outreach with stakeholders about, what improvements would look like. So, for example, it might be about developing objectives. It might be about considering whether some requirements could be removed or whether new ones were needed. At the moment, we are still you know, that is the debate that's happening. And the reason that I can't give you a straight answer at this point is because the very challenge that the board has is that some stakeholders would think the objective of a standards level review, if we did one, would be to look for excessive requirements and reduce them or to take away prescriptive language, whereas other stakeholders would think, you know, the priority would be looking for the things that are missing and going to talk to investors about what information they are not getting today that they would like. So there's a risk that if we did a standards level review, the expectations of those that think it's a good idea might not be met, because ultimately what would have to be done is to balance the views of all stakeholders on the particular standards that
if I may directly on that point, is it as black or white as you describe it, which sounds as if the investor side doesn't see an information overload problem?
I wouldn't say they do not see an information overload problem, but consistently, you know, a great majority of investors that we've spoken to, when we ask them what their concerns are, they say our number one concern is the stuff that's missing. They also have concerns about the way that the information that is there is being communicated. So, for example, you know, they'd like more tables and more disaggregation. When we ask them about disclosure overload specifically, that, you know, they don't say it's not a problem, but they say they would rather have the things that are missing than have the stuff that they're less interested in go away. You know, if it's a prioritisation of their concerns, it's the missing things that they're most.
Although there is
about.
Some overlap, right? Because a lot of what they seem to talk about is investors that they'd like to see more relevant information. If there was a focus on the really relevant stuff and less of the irrelevant stuff, that might indirectly deal with overload. So there's not a complete disconnect. It's just sort of how you get there. And I think if they had a choice between more or less, I'd rather focus on the more relevant than worrying so much about the detail per se.
Yes.
And that would be the objective of each disclosure, because at the end of the day, what we need to understand as preparer is what the user want to see. But if you, the approach could be different. Either you make a list and you cannot cover all the complexity of all the business, or working in principles, the users need to understand that, and that, and adapt the disclosure according to those principles. Maybe two or three things that are mandatory to have, but not a list of things.
Yes?
Yeah. First, let me start with my personal experience with this. When this document came out on disclosure principles of disclosure, in my organization, I took initiative and started looking at our financials and the way in which we can cut down the information. Aptly, the project was termed as Clear the Clutter Project, to get rid of information which is unnecessary. And before doing that, we started with 100 pages of financial statements. My target was to reach to 50 pages, believing that if you cannot tell a story in 50 pages, then what is the point of telling it in 500 pages? So we started with the project focused on areas where really excessive information was felt to be there in the financials, focused on pension-related disclosures, focused on financial instrument-related disclosure. I knew that 30 pages will go if we focus on that. And it happened. Finally, my target was to get back to 50, but we ended up with 70 pages. From 100 to 70, we could achieve that by changing the layout, the geography of information, etc., and rearranged everything. Definitely not changing the size of the font. So finally, we managed to do that, and this year when I looked at it, it had increased to 80 pages. Nothing to do with our financials, it is more to do with the auditor's long form audit report now. Earlier it was one page, now it has become 10 pages of audit report. Anyway, regardless of that, coming back to this point of whether it is excessive information or lack of information, I think even if you put relevant information, it gets hidden in the excessive disclosures. I think that would be one of the reasons investor is looking for information. It's difficult to find out in 240 pages where he has to search that information. That I would see that is the main problem. Even if there is relevant information, because of the size of disclosure, it gets hidden. Going back to the problem of this excessive disclosure, what I feel is first thing I can relate this to is not understanding the materiality concept, both by preparer as well as an auditor. I think both of them, if they are interpreting materiality wrongly, it will lead to additional disclosures, number one. Number two, there is a perception in the minds of preparer that if in doubt, disclose. And if there are any debates going on in terms of proper application of an accounting standard, or if there is any discussion relating to whether it is rightly done or not, preparer would definitely opt for disclosing whatever he has done. So disclosure doesn't compensate non-compliance, I'm sure. Everybody agrees for that. So in summary, I think we need to build up a mechanism in which excessive disclosure is penalized the way in which non-disclosure is penalized today. Right? If I don't disclose something, I know that I cannot get this audited and signed off by an auditor saying that this is in compliance with IFRS. What if I do excessive information? Then the auditor has no choice. Even if I put its management information, he cannot stop me writing that additional information. So he can still issue an audit report based on IFRS standards. So it is more of balancing between these two approaches. I think since you are also focusing on the materiality concept, materiality-related document you have come out with, and this initiative on disclosure principles, I think put together may help. But unless there is a mechanism to penalize excessive disclosure, I think people will continue to do the same.
And you would see it then as more of a behavioral problem than necessarily
Absolutely.
The wording in the standards.
Absolutely.
Back to Sandra's point, how big was the debate that you had to have with your auditors to cut those 30 pages?
Not much. In fact, they were very happy and willing to do that. But the initial, what I would like to highlight is somebody has to take initiative, and I think preparers are in good position to do that. But what is the incentive for them to do that? That's the next question you should ask.
You talked about a mechanism for penalising people for having excessive information in the financial statements. Have you any suggestions what that mechanism would be?
I cannot think of any. I think maybe it should come from a regulator.
Is there not a separate project for hiding information by unwanted, unwarranted information? That's another objective.
We have a project that's looking to revise the definition of materiality to include a reference to obscuring information. And I think that's getting to that sort of idea that you could potentially obscure material information with lots of immaterial information.
But is it a part of materiality project or it's a separate project?
It is part of the whole of the overall disclosure initiative project. So,
so that this obscuring, the principle of obscuring, it is... to prohibit that, will it not cover the point
what it's starting to do is it's starting to give regulators the tools to ask the question, why did you disclose this? Where I think regulators previously have felt that they can't get into that space.
Mm-hmm. And just to remind you, we amended IS-1 in 2014, and we introduced that idea of not obscuring the material information. And we emphasised it again in the materiality practice statement as well. So we've put some guidance out there. So hopefully it's helping people to some extent.
Ian?
Just to butt in on that, I mean, in Switzerland, our regulator actually has stated that if you deliberately obscure or confuse by over disclosure, this is something that they would challenge on. So actually in the regulator's guidance statement, our regulator's actually specifically said that. And I think that would be the... to answer your question, that would be the enforcement mechanism. I think I'm sure the regulators.
South African regulators done the same.
Yeah, I'm sure they speak to each other. So I think it's probably a trend that's coming on that.
Ian, while you're talking.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for congratulations on the agenda. It's very interesting topics. Just on the slides, I think very interesting that you say about sort of no time to apply. Judgment. I'm not sure in our case it's actually true. You could give us all the time in the world and it wouldn't actually help. I think there is in terms of what could be done, I think you could have a comprehensive, targeted solution. And let me expand on it. It's not that I think I would similarly be anxious that there's a comprehensive look, includes some open season on every standard where all disclosures could be up for discussion. I think a lot of it, quite a bit of the problem comes from the language that is used. Obviously, all the various standards have been written at different times by different people, and it's, this one says shall, and this one says should, and this one. I think you could go through the whole lot and just look at what's actually in every single standard, decide which ones people must disclose, which ones they should disclose if material, and which ones are they could consider disclose if they think it would be helpful. And I think the checklist can actually be useful to that, especially if you're in an emerging market or first-time preparer. The checklist, think, you know, did I think of all of this? That's helpful. Unfortunately, some of them, IFRS 2 springs to mind. It just says, you shall disclose this, and it gives a big long list of stuff. And I was just checking our financial statements. We've got 4.5 pages on IFRS 2, and we've got another 7 pages on pensions because of shall disclose. And it is interpreted that way, and particularly not everyone's a native English speaker, and a lot of these they get translated into different languages, and people can tell me, but I think if you say should in English and you translate that into German, that comes across as quite strong, and I think probably from my knowledge of Russian and Japanese also, if you should, it will come over as... And certainly our local auditors around the world do... There's a variety of interpretation from the auditors and the regulators about what you mean. I think you should go through and just be very honest. What do you actually, if you want to have a discussion about what must be disclosed, that's a legitimate discussion. There can be reasons where it must be. And then sort of go through and split it down like that. I think that would be in itself very helpful and actually apply that going forward. Maybe just in terms of what the analysts want, I never met an analyst or investor who wanted less information about anything. I think what they want is that it's well organised, and I think they're intelligent people that if they want to read 7 pages of Roche Group disclosures on pensions, they know where it is and they can find it. That's fine. All of this stuff has a cost to produce, and I think if you go to the investor, okay, guys, you know, if you want that, is there something? This is not free. So where does this come from? Somebody has to stop what they're doing and produce this stuff, and it's a big internal discussion. We're a commercial organisation. All the money I spend collecting disclosures is money that we don't have available to spend on finding the cure for cancer. I mean, that's literally what it is. So we're not in the game of providing nice-to-have disclosures. So if we can cut down the resources that are used to produce stuff that really people aren't so excited about, we're very happy to sort of put more effort into producing stuff that people would find useful. The problem is we don't have those internal resources to do it. And I can't go to my boss and say, okay, we should do a whole load of nice-to-have stuff when we're already overloaded chasing 15,000 operating leases and other stuff, and then you've got to disclose all that. So I think you've got to be a bit more... Got to have a bit of commercial here, but I think we're happy to look at more of the useful stuff. But I think you've got to not literally have a one in, one out, but I think some of the less useful stuff needs to be deprioritized, given a nice to have, and then if people want to do it, and then they can do it.
Actually, support Ian, because we do experience the big pressure from auditors because they do treat all the requirements as a must. And actually, it's weeks of discussions why we should, we didn't disclose it. So I do support that it should be clearly what is minimal required and what is nice to have. My personal view, I do like the language of IFRS 7, where it says you should describe the credit quality of the assets. They do not say how, and it's our choice. It's how systems and now credit management system, how we do it. It gives us the flexibility and also value for the user because they could see how we do it. On the feedback from the investors, we actually working quite close and ask our investor relationships what's the user's questions on the reports we issue. And fair enough, on financial instruments, which requires, I think, half of our financials, the only things that they're interested in is credit quality. All these levels, all these movements between levels, which is 10 pages, never had a question. So based on that, I think that the board should have a kind of research how they actually use it, because it costs us time and money. and we do not believe that they actually use it.
Do you think that there are some elements of information that you produce that are used at certain times? So, I mean, ex-banker as well, and we would find that things like the hierarchy would not be asked about at the year end when we produced the numbers, but 6 months later when there was a market event, they would come back to us to ask whether those numbers still held true and whether the effect was there. So some of these things are year-end specific, and some of them seem to come into play afterwards and event-driven.
I do believe that there should be a balance between interim reporting and the year-end, and also I do believe that there is a financial and there is a supplement to financials. And if investors would need to dip the numbers, they could ask for a supplement. It comes once a year, twice a year, once in 2 years' time, but at once, not every reporting.
The other question I wanted to ask, and this is probably for both you and Ian, we've talked about nice to have, and I don't think there's anything that we describe as nice to have. I suspect it's either in or out. But the question would be that to the more objective-based and the more principle-based the disclosure requirements are, Ian, to your point, the more I suspect you're going to have to spend senior time on deciding what should be in and what shouldn't be in. The nice thing about the old lists is you could just sort of apply them as is. So are you comfortable with the idea that that's what's going to happen? You are going to spend more resources in thinking about what should be in the financials?
That's true. And actually, from internal point of view, as a financial department, if I had the requirements, it's quite easy to just to do it, not think, not to discuss. Just do it, and that's it. Would it help somebody? How much it costs? Doesn't matter. So it would require more time, more senior time, and more discussion with the auditors, I also expect.
Stefan? A little bit along the line what we were discussing. And first of all, the users are very different. I mean, that's a very broad range, right, of people, which starts from regulators to financial analysts to investors, which are reading financial statements. And all of them have very different interests. To the question on, I haven't seen a regulator actually pushing on having less disclosed. I mean, the questions which at least we receive is always disclose more. When it then comes to the auditors, actually, the auditor itself is less of an issue when it comes to discussing or bringing up things which you should take away. But then comes a lawyer, which works and reviews on behalf of the auditor, actually. And specifically, actually, the lawyers which have a U.S. background, when you have a registration in the U.S., they push, actually, for more disclosures. So our largest discussion when we prepare our annual statements is around, even if you have mentioned one item in one place, the lawyer asks you to put it in the same information in another place just to be 100% safe from a regulator perspective or lawsuit perspective and so on and so forth. So I think that is a little bit the challenge which we have when we talk with the regulators. If you then go to the other end, when you look on financial analysts, what we see is actually the number of financial analysts following. I mean, they are also under cost pressure, so you have fewer financial analysts actually following your reports and writing reports of this one, which means they need to find the information fast, quickly, in a well-organized way. They certainly always want to have more of information, but when you ask them, do you have actually time to digest them, they usually answer no. And when you ask them around, do you actually understand what is in the disclosure, what is really the financial background of that one, you also get on very shaky ground, and probably three financial analysts understand the same thing in three completely different ways, and you spend hours on explaining that. So I think there would be a huge, I mean, it's not more is the right answer to work on. But, I mean, when you look on the new standards coming up, they drive more. When I look on IFRS 15, what I'm going to write around revenue recognition in the future, that will be three pages more, probably more in the report compared to what I had before. So what you see with every new standard, where you become more prescriptive, actually is the size of the stand, or what you write around it will become actually longer. So from my perspective, I think it would be good actually a little bit around the lines to say what can you actually take away, like the length of pension publications, what we write around the pension note, what we sometimes need to write in financial notes, what we need to write on remuneration of executives. It's also a long number of pages which we have there on the notes. I think that would be very much welcome.
So Stefan, two questions on that. The first would be, when you say taking away like that, are you talking about preparers need to actively take away? Or are you saying that the ISB needs to take away something?
I think preparers need to have a little bit help because, I mean, you know, as I said, you know, my biggest debate, it's not the auditor, it's the lawyer behind the auditor, which says you will be exposed to questions or things like that.
I'm going to then ask the second question, which is that to the extent that disclosure requirements become more principle-based, you need to disclose the information that is useful to the users of your financial statements about what you're doing. Does that increase or decrease the legal input on the financial statements? Because does that not actually raise the game and that the lawyers are going to ask you what is important?
I think it will raise the game. On the other side, I think if you would have it more on a principle perspective and you really write once the reasoning behind down, if not, I think in all of the cases, at the end of the day, the important thing is that you have documented in a well-described way the reasoning on what you have been doing. I think that would help, actually.
Verna?
I'm kind of skeptical about the idea that reduction, that removing prescriptive requirements for you would somehow produce more relevant information being disclosed. I kind of like having the certain disclosure requirements using words like shall or must, because it somehow empowers the accounting department to interact with other departments within each organization and this way, produced information needs to be disclosed. I found it strange to hear that users complain about not getting relevant information because they participate in the process of establishing the disclosure requirements. So When we have a disclosure requirement of a new standard saying that something needs to be disclosed, that an entity shall disclose something, that comes from a request made by these users. So how come these requirements are not producing relevant information if they set these requirements? So my perception, and it's a very subjective one, is that these requirements are not expensive to them, so to the entities it's really expensive to comply with them, to provide all this information. But to the users, I don't know if they are precisely valuing the how expensive it is to produce that information and whether they will actually use it in their models and because they certainly will find everything interesting about anything that we present from our financial statement, but whether they will actually use it to make a decision, that's something else. And if you accept that there are some circumstances that cannot be overcome, for instance, materiality, it's really difficult to reach a consensus about what is material and what is not. If you have a process in which the users precisely define what they really, really want to be disclosed, and that information is required, it shall be disclosed. So removes a lot of burden to the preparers and the auditors and the regulators to discuss what is material and what is not. So that would be predefined when the standard is being developed. So that's actually something.
I think it does raise a point that was raised by somebody else around the table, though, is that no standard can fully anticipate every event. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes the problem where it needs to come in.
Yes.
Christoph?
Yeah, I think directly on that. I always wonder, what is the world we need to have in mind when deciding on whether to make a disclosure? Because a lot of disclosures people find useful, but only under certain circumstances. So it's a bit like, is that disclosure useful? Not now, but if there was a new financial crisis, it would be. So what alternative scenarios do you need to consider? And the more you need to consider, the more disclosures you need to make. But the lower the probability that they will be actually used, because you get into scenarios that are unlikely. And I think a lot of what I hear of as disclosure requests from investors are these just-in-case requests. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I would like that. I don't think I need it, but there may be a scenario coming up, and then that would be a useful disclosure. And I think there is a lack of clarity about the world you've got to imagine when thinking about the disclosures. So is it more like a telephone directory, and the elder ones may still remember these were yellow books we had in the past. Some people may argue, let's delete the letter X, because there are hardly any names under X. If you say no, but maybe I need to call someone whose name has the letter X. So what is the approach? If the approach is let's cover each and every possible scenario, then of course I understand a lot of the requests from investors. While if it is something like let's imagine the world to continue as it currently stands at the time of producing the financial statement, then I think for a lot of disclosures investors would struggle to justify why they would be useful. But because we are very unclear on this notion of what should we have in mind when deciding on materiality, I think that is, to me, one of the biggest things. Another point is the frequency of disclosures. If I think what we call the copy and paste disclosures, which we copy from one set to the next year and to the next year and to the next year, and there's a significant portion of what we have in our financial statement that is copy and paste stuff. Financial risk management is a very good example. Companies don't tend to change that every year or every quarter. And to me, if I looked at it and say, well, what is making it most difficult to identify the important stuff? It's exactly that, the copy and paste stuff. But the standard currently wouldn't allow me to say, well, just pick last year's statement, it's in there, or I've got it somewhere on my website. I think we are still very much in a world where there is a paper set of financial statements, and I have nothing else in the world than this. And that's why there needs to be everything in there. But if you think of a world of being on HTML, hyperlinking and all that, repeating information again and again doesn't fit into that world. And that's why if I were an investor, I would say, come on, the only thing I want from you is a disclosure of what changed in your accounting policies. I don't want to repeat all your accounting policies. If I need to know them, then tell me where I can find them in a one-time.
Christoph, and perhaps jumping back to then the question, so do you think that we should be doing a specific review of individual standards but bearing in mind these overarching principles?
So I think the shell thing, yes, is a small, maybe more a signal than something that will have a significant value. If I see the discussions we have around the IFRS 15 disclosures, where it says, well, disaggregate your revenue, and here are some examples of how you can disaggregate them. And the auditors come, now show me for each and every one of these examples, give me a memo that says it's not material, otherwise disclose it. So, and there isn't the word shell in there. So that's why I think the help of removing the word shell is a tiny bit.
It's a signaling.
It's a more signaling thing. I think overall, if there was a rule that said you are prohibited from disclosing immaterial information, That, of course, would change the game.
So something to tilt the scale the other way.
That would change the game completely, because then you would force auditors and preparers into the discussion whether something is truly material.
And then that comes back to the earlier discussion about obscuring and whether we need to think a bit more about how we play that out. Did you want to come in, or were you, Iwaki, or you?
Yes, I'm the same view with Mario, what he said. So the prescriptive language is sometimes helpful because it provides some guidance for preparer to determine what to be disclosed. So, but I want to minimize the number of those prescriptive language in the standard. That's one point. Still, I think, you know, the materiality consideration is a very important piece. So materiality, you know, interpretation should reside in the preparer's hand. Otherwise, you know, it can go dangerous direction. So it goes to too much excessive information disclosure. So the balance is important, but yeah, the materiality interpretation, that is very key, important concept for us to keep some freedom.
Then lastly, the three of you. Ian first.
George. Something you said just sort of picked up. You said, what can the ISB do to help? And I think we talk about, sure, the preparers can do more, but I think the people in this room, myself, we're sufficiently experienced and competent and confident to be able to challenge and push back and have arguments with the auditors, the regulators, and whoever. But there are a whole bunch of other companies that aren't. In Switzerland, there's a whole bunch of other companies that are smaller, that are using IFRS. They don't have our resources or experience. And then if you're looking at emerging markets and so on, how is someone supposed to do that? And I think you can actually help out by being more specific along the lines I've mentioned to actually help people to do it. I think it's very nice to say, yeah, the preparers should apply a judgment, but then we all need something to work at, and the people in this room, we can sort of relate to that, but not everybody's in that boat. And you see it in Switzerland, you see some smaller companies who were preparing under IFRS are moving back to Swiss GAAP because they find it less onerous, particularly on the financial instruments disclosures. And this is, you know, not something the local regulators like particularly. It's not something as an IFRS philosophically I like to see happening. But that's what's actually happening on the ground, and I'm sure that you in emerging markets, maybe they don't have a choice, but I think you can help us out to move in the direction that we're talking about here. We're all probably quite capable to do that, but we're by definition a very small subset of all the preparers worldwide, and probably in that respect not a very typical subset.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
In terms of what we could do to help, Peter already mentioned that a couple of years ago there was an amendment to IS1 that's been effective for about 2 years now that essentially said, and I'm paraphrasing hugely, you know, if something that is required by IFRS standards is not material, don't give it. And I just wonder if you've got an opinion, given your comments, on the extent to which that has proven helpful to the companies you describe, or whether it is literally only individual standard-level activity that would make a genuine difference.
That didn't help at all. That really passed under the radar screen. You've got these, you know, IFRS 2, IFRS 3, you've got these big, long lists. Shall people do that? And it's exactly as you articulate. You know, even you've got a... The burden is on you to actually, as the preparer, to actually prove that it's not material. And actually, you not only have that discussion with the audience once, they then come back the next year and say, oh, by the way, have you updated this? Can you still prove that it's not material? And to prove it's not material, you've got to collect the information in the first place anyway. So once you've done that, sorry, but that's the way it is. And sort of you get the behaviour that you incentivise here.
And do you think we could ever avoid that? Because even if we went into the individual standards and reminded people that, you know, used a word other than shall or made it clear that these are the requirements, if it's material. Because I think we'd always want to say, if it's material, then we could check the list, but we assume this is the list that should apply if it is material. Aren't they always going to have that discussion with the auditors?
I think it would help if each standard where there's a list of stuff that you specifically said, someone wrote it down, I can't remember what I said, but, you know, what is compulsory, what is should if material, what is sort of could be helpful to readers, and actually have precisely the same wording in every single standard and get a very nice wording of that that you can translate into different languages that everybody is 100% clear what you mean. And I think that's part of the problem. And people aren't clear what you mean. And then you get different groups. It's cultural, it's language, it's conservative, not conservative, whatever. And that's where you get the variability from. Because what you have in the standards is not precisely and surgically exactly what you want to say. And it's different across the various standards. So I think if you even just aligned on that, that would actually help quite a bit.
But I'm always worried about the expectations management, and I hear what you're saying, but even the stuff that is in theory compulsory, I think is always subject to materiality. I'm not going to say you have to disclose it if it's completely immaterial for the particular preparer. So I think we'd probably have some stuff that we'd say, if it's material, you have to disclose it, to use your compulsory language. Then we might have some stuff that would be, these are the things you should maybe think about. Again, I think it would always have some sort of element of materiality attached to it and making the assessment of if it's relevant.
But you could have a little standard paragraph. I'm making up as I go along now, but you could have a little standard paragraph saying just remind everybody in each standard, the principles of disclosure, sort of, if it's material, bump to bump to bump. It's within your wisdom to do that. And you can have basically the principles of disclosure in a different standard actually aren't there. Each standard has its considerations, but once you've decided there's stuff that people should disclose, there's a number of options about what you then do it. And it's not that you have different levels of materiality for different standards. You should go through the same thought process for each standard. So, there's things we should think about disclosing. What should they be? I think having the list there is actually quite helpful. As I said, it's a reminder. But then I think you should just be crystal clear and absolutely consistent about what actually you want.
I mean, I wonder if there's... one of the problems we've got is materiality. We've always expressed as a kind of on-off switch. It's either material that's disclosed or it's not material that doesn't have to be disclosed. And I wonder if... The problem is that in reality it's kind of more of a scale, and so as something gets bigger, you expect more to be disclosed. So take as an example. If you've got a very small pension scheme, not much of the information is going to be material. Maybe none of it will be material if it's a very small scheme. If you've got a kind of medium-sized scheme with not many risks, then a bit more information is going to be material. You're going to want to disclose a bit more. And if your pension scheme is enormous and there are lots of risks in it, then lots of information is going to be material. And I wonder if the way we've set these things up don't encourage that way of thinking very well. It was interesting in our discussion with our investors group, the CMAC, a few years back. One of the members had a go at categorising the pension disclosure requirements into kind of three buckets. The ones that you'd like to need in most cases if the pension is some sort of reasonable size. The next lay up you'd want if the scheme's a bit bigger. And then the extra stuff you need if it's a kind of mega scheme. I wonder if that's the kind of thing we should be thinking about exploring in some way.
Richard?
On your specific question, IS1, it's a lot harder discussion with the auditors about qualitative materiality. And the best example is probably IFRS 7, when you've got disclosure about financial instruments. If your financial instruments are predominantly derivatives, which are cash flow hedges, you might argue that there was really no significant risk to disclose about the financial instruments because that's not the risk for the business because they're actually hedging. So, but to have that discussion with the auditors is quite a hard sell because of the way that IFRS 7 is written. It doesn't. It's all about the financial risk of financial instruments, but it doesn't give you any kind of an out at the beginning to say that if financial instruments aren't particularly risky to your business, then don't do any of this. It would be helpful, I think, if you could do some emphasis like that to help in the materiality. And the other item that I think you should do is make sure that all the examples, when you give examples, disclosures, that all the examples are material. So we've had the discussion where we're saying, well, we're not going to disclose that because it's not material, because it's only X percent. And they say, well, the example the ISB gave, it's the line item is only 1%, so therefore the ISB must think 1% material. So you have to make sure that your examples are clearly material.
Sandra, last word.
A few people talked about cost, and I think when you're evaluating the cost of the disclosures, you also have to think about the time commitment involved in all the costs. If you have your controllers organization spending all their time on pulling together the required disclosure, quantitative disclosure, do they really have the time to sit back and make the judgments and decide qualitatively we want to, you know, highlight this area or move this area? If they're spending all their time on all the base required information, you take out that level of judgment and discussion that I think is necessary when you're preparing your financial statements.
Okay, thank you very much. That is all extremely helpful feedback for us. I will move on to the second discussion topic, which I believe will be quite a bit shorter. So this point is really about the fact that in and amongst all of the feedback we got, a lot of constituents told us that they felt we needed to prioritise and narrow the focus of the project to the things that would be most helpful. So some of the things that the board considered in the discussion paper are listed on slide 12. In something of a priority order, in the sense that this could be a perception that one might get from all of the feedback that we had in terms of relative importance. So I won't talk through everything on the slides. You've got it in front of you. But the question really is whether you would agree with that sort of ordering of priority that appears on slide 12, and which of the things on those lists you would regard as being the ones that the IASB should spend some time trying to help with.
I might as well pick it up.
Yeah.
It's a bit quiet. I like the word guidance, but requirements I'm not so hot on. I think it's really in the preparer's hands to sort of give the best story that portrays the corporation in the best way. There's some great examples around the globe on streamlining financials. It's been an example of one here today, and in Australia it's certainly been a hot topic for the last sort of 3 years. So one thing, just in terms of the order, so just on that, I think being less prescriptive, more as a view, is the better, although there'll be different views on that. I think non-infrastructure information side of the information is a pretty hot topic at the moment. As we've noted in the capital markets advisory group discussion we've had, there is a disconnect between what a lot of organisations are telling the story in the front half of the financials versus what's actually under the infrastructure information. So if we can close that gap or align it, I think that's a whole topic. It's probably a priority that I'd want to see happen if we can. And then in terms of formatting and location of accounting policies, I'm just wondering, is that being prescriptive or a requirement of they must format it this way or locate policies here or there? Because that's one, that's pretty big areas, I think, in it's in the best judgment of preparers or if their financials.
And do you think it would be helpful in those cases if, for example, the board were to prepare some non-mandatory educational type guidance?
I think so, yes. Yeah. And I think if it's on the disclosure project that you've embarked on for a little while now, there's some good case studies out there, and thankfully we're one of them, so it lines up as part of that. Along those themes, I think we're on the right track.
Could I ask another question? So as I think you mentioned that you've experienced some positive momentum in terms of improving disclosures. Given that you've seen that being done based on what is available today, sort of the frame with this question is what is the most useful things the board can do? And I just wonder if you have a view on, given that some companies in some jurisdictions have been able to make improvements in things like formatting and location, etc., based on what is available already today, do you think those things would be a priority for the board? Like what's the most useful thing you think we could focus our time on?
So I'm just trying to understand the question. I think you're asking is the ease you can sort of get to that stage, what's the most useful and the priorities. I think we've touched on non-infrastructure information, etc. I think on the disclosure initiative being laying more judgment in the hairs of preparers to get to the stage, the one, two, the better. Less prescriptive. I think we've been talking in the early session about thou shalt, etc., that type of stuff. While we found it easier to get to a set of financials, are much more streamlined, a lot more user-friendlier, drop notes such as, say, pension schemes where they're closed or not relevant, or where those pension members get standalone financials information in any event. So that's helpful. The hardest task is obviously dealing with the auditors on this. That's where the real work comes into play. So the less prescriptive and more guidance, I think, would help the auditors go through the process. As we heard, the auditors go through their sort of technical disclosure requirements, and sort of that can quite often create a bottleneck in getting what I think is a much more user-friendly set of financial statements out. I think that's what you're asking.
Yeah, yes, it was. Thank you.
I think some of the items on here are interesting, but I don't think they should be a focus because I struggle to see what the outcome could be. Like IFRS information outside financial statements. The area that the ISB is working on are the financial statements. So I think anything like use of IFRS information outside could only be a practice statement recommendation or anything. Yeah. So that's why I struggle to see what the outcome could be in a way of that this becomes mandatory or other things. And that's why I think that shouldn't be a focus topic. The entire location topic, as I hope that in a few years we are more in the use of means of communicating financial information where location doesn't really play a significant role. So that's why I think, because the effort is not an effort of a few months, that may not be well spent because it would then be spent on the old idea of having paper financial statements. So that's why I wouldn't make that a focus.
Can I ask you a quick question? I would have thought an example of, and I'll check with Catherine here, of IFRS information outside the financial statements may in fact be the risk report that you were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. That you don't necessarily need to have it in
From that direction. I understood it.
How do you
have to mark if you use stuff outside to distinguish them from non-IFRS? But if it is something like you don't have to present in, then I'm with you. That's my copy and paste thing. How can I eliminate stuff from the statement that is in particular not changing at a high frequency? So that copy and paste thing, as I call it, I think that should be a focus because that will help to reduce the financial statements to clearly below 50 pages, I would assume. I think a further focus should be on the circumstances under which disclosures are to be made. So what I talked about, like the world I've got to keep in mind when thinking about disclosing things. I think that is something that for me would be a high priority. And finally, the level of precision of disclosures, because we're currently very much black or white. Give me a number or don't do anything. And whenever people ask for table, that's usually numbers. Oftentimes, people are happy if you give them a range. Yeah. But if disclosures look like it needs to be presented in a table, ranges in tables is more difficult. So to really consider that it's not disclosed or not, but sometimes the precision of disclosure, qualitative or quantitative, even if quantitative, given a range rather than a precise number, helps, prepares it less cost to produce, because the moment I've got to give a precise number, I've got to go down to levels that I would not consider otherwise. And I think preparers will be more willing to make the disclosures because they get a little bit more of room in the way of, I'm not really sure how much it is, but I would be feel comfortable with giving a range, but I would not be comfortable with giving a precise number. And I think oftentimes the investor is only interested in the range. He's not interested whether it's 1.5 or 1.7 million. He's interested whether it's rather 1 million or 100 million. And I think that will be something that would be useful to be considered in the project.
Ian?
Just one thing sort of jumped out, and it came from our group in Switzerland as well, about what exactly you mean by non-IFRS information here. I think if you mean alternative performance measures, I'd rather suggest being specific about that, and that's maybe not even part of this project. But the way we read the disclosure draft was, if it ain't specified in a standard, then it is by definition non-IFRS information. And if I look even at our ones, for example, in our segment note, we give a split of R&D by segment, and that's not in the standard. So is that now non-IFRS information? Do we have to justify why we're doing that? Do we have the auditors asking? Yeah. be careful how you're doing this, because a lot of the time, we're giving additional information. We give a split of stock option expense by cost centres because some people like to take it out. We don't agree with that, but okay, there are the numbers. We've got them. Here you go. It's not actually an IFRS 2. Some of our colleagues in Switzerland and in other countries actually put extra stuff in the pension note because they want to put a little bit of stuff about the statutory status because it might show, IAS 19 might show that their pension fund is sort of not in underfunded on a statutory basis. It might be okay. They'd like to have the option to do that. Do you want to stop them doing that? I think there's two different things. I think there's the whole discussion about APMs, which is a legitimate discussion. But then there's a whole other area where people are just giving extra stuff, extra information on an IFRS basis, splits that is not required by the standard, just to try and be helpful. Do you want to discourage that? Do you want to stop that? I think you need to be a bit careful about what you mean here.
Hello? Yes, I had the same comment of Ian relating to our non-IFRS indicators, mainly what is relating to what is today defined in the P&L or the financial statement. They are not all the lines defined in the IFRS itself. We choose some lines according to our business. So we consider that as IFRS, but we don't know what you are intending to define on that. I have another comment relating to IFRS information outside the financial statement. I agree with Christoph, and I will add we had some experience related to IFRS 7, where we could put outside a financial statement the risk relating to financial instrument. And in my experience, that doesn't work because, at least in Europe, the issue is relating to the auditors. The auditors don't accept to review things outside the financial statement, so you may have some issues relating to that. And my third comment is relating to the accounting policies to disclose. I don't understand. Maybe I understand the comment if you are disclosing accounting policies, a copy-paste of the IFRS. Maybe the accounting policies, even if are disclosed at the beginning of the financial statement, should be a user guide in order to read the financial statement that come after that. I don't know what is the intent of this project, but in my opinion, it's only my opinion, the accounting policy should be a user guide. That should be how we apply in our organization such accounting policies.
Thank you. Anne?
I wanted to pick up on the comment that Colin was speaking to. One of the things we've talked about at the board table is that there are some entities who have done things with their disclosures, so we think you can do it within the set of standards that presently exist. But equally, we're hearing there are barriers in changing people's disclosure. So I'm just wondering if Colin has any ideas about how the board might act to facilitate companies like Wesfarmers who did actually change their disclosure package. You mentioned auditors as being a barrier. I'm just wondering if there are any suggestions you have for us of things that we could do to facilitate entities like yours that did want to make a change.
One thing we did to make a change is find out what the users really want. So we actually met with a lot of investor groups, a lot of analysts, one who report on our stock, and found out what was really most important to them. So it was really about putting the most relevant information first and really reducing the clutter, duplications, making the easy read, and really organising the whole set account into what's significant, what's happened, capital structure, to getting rid of accounting policies at the front, apart from what's important or what's changed, and putting them alongside the notes with key judgments along those notes in key numbers, numbers that are not key numbers, they're down the back. Accounting policies, some are required to be disclosed. Those, in our mind, are not relevant. They're at the back. So you've got accounting policies by key numbers and you've got other accounting policies. They're right down the back. But the key to it is open engagement with your stakeholders and internally and externally, and find out what's most important for themselves. And one thing we also did, we met personally with the regulator in Australia's case, that's ASIC, and got their views before going from a path of cutting some financials by about 45% was the end result. So it's really about just we've sort of been quite proactive and reorganising the whole set of accounts and letting them give the story.
Did you give the auditors a head up?
No, we did. So we had them. I think the key is to have your regulator, your auditors, and your stakeholders engaged from day one before we embark on this. It's a much easier process. And saying that, when I said it was not hard, you know, there is a lot of time required in orders and getting through why you're dropping certain notes, disclosures, etc. There's upfront pain, but there's a lot more long-term gain once you're through that.
Thank you.
Srinath?
Yeah. I have a suggestion, but I don't know how far it can be implemented practically because a lot of people are required to be involved. If I'm a preparer, I want to look for best practice cases for disclosure. Where should I look at? That is the first thing. I'm sure that few companies are doing very well in terms of how the standards have to be applied and minimum disclosure you can come out with. So when, if as a preparer, if I am asking this question, can you give me 5 companies where I can look at least as a reference point? You may say, we are standard setters, we have nothing to do with that. Auditors, if I ask, they may say, this is my firm-related client, so we can only give that. So as a preparer, there is a difficulty to find a reference point.
We have actually had an exercise along those sorts of lines where we took some companies who'd gone through an exercise of trying to increase the effectiveness of the disclosures in their financial statements, and West Farmers was one of the examples that we used, and we produced a report that set out, I think it was 6 or 7 companies who'd gone through that exercise, what they'd done and who they'd talked to and the processes that they'd gone through in order to improve their disclosures. And if you find it useful, we can certainly forward that to you.
Sure. And I'm not only talking about this project as the principles of disclosure. In general, on an annual basis, you can come out with a list of, say, 5 to 10 companies, which you feel you can put all your disclaimers there. But at least as a reference point for the preparer, at least these are the good practices.
So a lot of jurisdictions actually already have annual competitions.
Yes, I do agree.
That might be something that we don't necessarily need to endorse the competition, but we can point to where those competition results are.
I think there's potentially a bigger question here in the sense that it's like that kind of information would be useful to companies, and you know we have done something related in the past, and I think there is a perception from some people that we hear on our educational materials that because it's not in the standards themselves, there's a lot of people who are, you know, busy doing their day-to-day jobs, aren't following everything that the IASB does, and therefore just aren't aware that that information exists. And so those people have said to us that, you know, for something the board does to be wide-ranging and useful, it needs to be in the standards, whereas actually if there's an argument that if we could find a way to make that other material that isn't in the standards easier to access, that might make a difference. I think that sounds...
And maybe a word of caution. Occasionally we are asked whether we would allow that disclosures we make are presented in a book that is on a certain topic. I can't recollect that we've ever been asked on something where we disclose only little information. Usually you are asked to serve as a reference where you disclose to the last detail. So I don't know whether such competition are competitions in best disclosures or whether they are competition in max disclosure. Which is understandable if you write an article or a book about it to say, well, this was a great one, they didn't say anything about it. I don't think you would find that. But hey, they disclosed 3 pages on the topic, 9 pages on pension. That is what will be shown up as an example. So I think there is some bias in these exercises, and that may not go into the right direction, that what is the right level of disclosure, but rather what is the max level of disclosure.
So his 70 pages will go up to 100 pages again.
Although I would say about the best communication case studies that we did, that focused on areas where entities had looked to try and improve their disclosure.
I wasn't commenting on that.
Yeah, and in some cases, actually, there was significant streamlining, and that was actually highlighted as one of the things that had come out of it. So it isn't all focus on volume.
Erin?
Yeah.
The question is that of prioritization, as I get it. Because on all the items, there are a whole lot of commentaries. More than 80 people have commented. I consider out of this, in all the items written here, I consider only two items relevant. One is the IFRS inside and IFRS information outside the information in the statement, and the non-IFRS information inside the financial statement. Personally, non-IFRS information inside the financial statement, there should not be any restriction. We have regulatory problems. By regulation, we may have to include it, so we'll have practical difficulty if the standard setter is preventing from doing that. But when it comes to IFRS information outside the financial statement, I shared the experience with Liliana, what she said, is that something lying outside this financial statement, auditor, or that has to be audited in any case, and the auditor doesn't like it. So it will be very difficult for most geographies to get it through the auditors. But leave aside, I'm not commenting much on that because the question is prioritization. As I said, these are the only two items which are prioritized items. Take, for example, disclosure for accounting policy, which has been kept at priority one here. Now, it talks about creating three categories. If you create three categories, then again we start debating on, we're creating three silos, and then again we start debating on, debating first at the standard setter level, and then again preparer versus auditor. No, this should enter into the second category. No, I think that it should enter into the third category. So you are creating another trouble for me. So that is one concern I have. And second concern is that the location. Now, first of all, location issue is less important with the technology now, because in any case, you can cross-referencing is not a problem at all. You can hyperlink, so therefore the moment you are hyperlinked, the location becomes a lesser of an issue. And that is the reason I think the disclosure of accounting policy is a low priority item. Take the case of present and disclose in the IFRS standard. You see as preparer and also have gone through the commentaries of the auditors, none of us are considering this as an issue at all. So why should we keep this as a priority item at all, is a question I'm asking. Take the case of formatting. Now, the principles of effective communication, say this has been set out in paragraph 2.6 of the DP, and we do feel that the principles should be made mandatory. And the principle should be included in IAS 1, and the IASB should not attempt to issue application guideline. Now, on the question of application guideline, I'll just quote one example. In table 2.1 or paragraph 2.22 of the DP, there is a suggestion that the graphs and charts will be better communication for showing sales figures by geographical area or business segment. I'm questioning this sentence. So that may be true for one industry, that may not be true for another industry. So therefore, the moment you start issuing application guidance in this format, you're again creating another kind of a problem. So this may be true in one case, this may not be true in another case. In my case, it is definitely not true. So therefore, I feel that let us prioritize this IFRS and non-IFRS thing, and then other items also. In any case, you've got a lot of commentaries on that. Some of the items need to be dropped from this project altogether. That also is the comment you have got. I think accordingly, the prioritization, what you have given here, has to be revised.
Yeah, thank you. Maru?
I have a question and I can comment. I remember this most of these topics here being discussed in previous GPF meetings, but I don't remember this clarifying the use of present present and disclose in a finished data? What is that exactly?
So that was within the section of the DP that talked about the roles of the primary financial statements and the notes. It was a section within that chapter. And it essentially talked about the fact that throughout IFRS standards, the terms present and disclose are not used consistently, and some stakeholders would like us to either define what those two terms mean or in future always explain where things should be. So, for example, present on the face of the financial statements or disclose in the notes, because at the moment some tell us they're confused about whether disclose always means the notes or whether present always means the financial statements. So it's about clarifying the use of those terms, essentially.
I put that on the bottom of this list here, but I don't know if it's pertinent to this part of the discussion, but I still think that these are all very interesting topics, but most importantly, I think it would be to improve the process of gathering the views of users and extracting from that what is really, really important that needs to be disclosed in the financial statements. Again, this is really a subjective perception that I have, but my feeling is that still a lot of requests are being posed, are being made for more information, and I'm not sure if all of these requests are really, really necessary. There's also something else related to this disclosure issue, which is the increasing the complexity of the standards. So, I find it amazing how the complexity of these standards is increasing compared to older standards, and it's unavoidable that you might have a greater need of disclosure of information on how these accounting methodologies are applied. But I also find interesting because at the same time I noticed that some users are not specialists in the application of these standards. So how come they need that information, which they are not totally acquainted on how that information is used when the methodology is applied? For instance, some users express the view that they need the accounting policies because they are not experts and they need that to understand what the accounting procedures were. But that's a very simplified description of the accounting, the application of the accounting standards. Someone needing that explanation, how can he really comprehend the type of disclosure that is so detailed and being provided about the application of a very complicated methodology?
And I think frequently the answer there is that they might not be accounting experts, but they are valuation experts.
Yes.
So looking to understand the drivers of the valuations that you put on your balance sheet is useful.
But is that information being actually used in their evaluation process? That's a point.
Well, and I think that's a fair question. I think that is a part of the process the board typically goes through. I think it's a fair comment that we should continue to go through that. Jura.
Thank you. I have a very short comment about the clarifying of the use of the present and the disclose. And as Barindra said, if this is just a simple clarification between two technical terms, and I don't think it has a higher priority. However, in terms of present, if you include in this discussion how to structure the line items, for example, in the income statement, that would be more useful for us. And for example, how to apply, how to choose between the structure by nature or by function. In that case, if you have some deeper discussion in applying those two different interpretations, or more preferably, if we have a more clear definition about each line item, then that would be more preferable for us.
That's not something that's actually been addressed as part of this particular project, but it is very much on the board's mind as part of the primary financial statements project, which we're going to come on to talk about later on today.
I think we've touched on, quite a few people have touched on the technology issue. So perhaps without going through the intro, does anybody want to add anything more about technology, and specifically whether we should be considering technology as part of this project? And I think a couple of different people did pick up on it as we went through.
Sorry, not related to technology before getting into that. I just wanted to highlight as a preparer, principles of disclosure is very, very important for us. Some of this needs to be communicated to the board that this should be prioritized. I know that the board is busy with a lot of other standards as well, but this is something which will be very useful. It would increase the credibility of the financials. So this is quite important as a project as a whole.
Maybe only one comment, which is kind of question, is principle-based disclosures and XBRL a contradiction? So how do I imagine XBRL as an XBRL taxonomy if the disclosure requirements were fully principle-based? But what would be the tags in the taxonomy other than company-specific extensions, if there's nothing prescribed? So that's a notion, I think, that needs to be considered in the discussion around how far do we move to the principle-based side, that and take away the use case for XBRL.
On technology, I have one point. One is that the standard criticism on the technology thing is that technology is ever-changing. So does it mean that as and when the technology changes, I go on changing the standard also? No, that's not a valid criticism for the simple reason that as the technology as it exists today, you have to take advantage of that. And as and when things improve, in any case, we have improvement plan and we have many other means to change that. So that's number one point. The how to use the technology, I mean, this has been discussed already in the DP and the response to DP. I'm not going into that. But one important point here is that technology, there are some geography which may not be in a position to take full advantage of the technology which is required by the standard setter. For example, when you say that, well, put a hyperlink on the items, right? Then there could be a geography where the regulator has not yet gone for this hyperlinking. Now, I suggest that they let the standard setters say that whether the regulator wants it or not, you have to hyperlink. Secondly, whether you are putting it in the website or not, it may not be compulsory in some geography. In our geography, it is compulsory. But whether it's putting in the website is compulsory or not, you have to hyperlink. So therefore, if you are under IFRS, you have to follow this level of technology. This is one suggestion what I am putting for consideration. That, I mean, if you start looking at, for example, taxonomy. Now, whether...
Do you mind if I cut you short there? I think we're coming up to lunchtime, but I think we've got the point that you're talking about, so I think that's useful. So did you want to come in just as the last word there?
It's not going to be a stress-run. But just, I think you raise a very good question, Christoph, that this sort of potential tension between the specificity that the taxonomy might suggest and the desire of some for more principles-based standards. But I think it's a sort of close cousin to another, I think, tricky issue that we've got to deal with in this project. Because to me, what worries, I'm less concerned about trying to reconcile the tendency for preparers to be focused on reducing disclosure and investors being focused on more relevant information, because I think you could sort of get to the same place by having more relevant information and less irrelevant information, and you'd sort of achieve both. The one that I think is more of a tension for me, and I still haven't got my head around it, is
perhaps a more general desire from preparers to have more principles-based disclosure requirements and more of an ability to shape the financial statements to tell your story. I can use that general term. And a lot of comments from investors and users of financial statements that they like comparability and the ability to make direct comparisons. And I'm still struggling to work out how we reconcile those two objectives. And I find that harder to reconcile, actually, than the sort of clutter versus relevance part of the equation.
But I think it's a basic question whether financial statements should be a crime story or a dictionary. So far, I've never seen anyone who took a set of financial statements and said, I've got to go to the last page. I want to know how the story ends. Fun aside, I think that is very much about the disclosure. That's very much what I said earlier about what are the scenarios I've got to keep in mind. Do I need to keep the letter X in there? That is the dictionary approach. And then, of course, let's put all disclosures in that could be useful in even unrealistic scenarios. Or am I really telling the story? Then a lot of that is the what I call the just-in-case disclosures. They would not be in there if I want to tell a story. And I think that's where sometimes investors say they would like to hear the story, the equity story. But then if they insist on certain disclosures, they appear to be more in the dictionary world. So I think that may be a very fundamental question, what are financial statements supposed to be? And as long as we don't solve that, the tension that you mentioned is absolutely there and will continue to be there.
Okay, thank you. You got what you need?
Yes, we have. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. We're going to take a break for lunch.